brought to you by Leave the Ring Network. All boxing, no filter.
Oh! That's another knockdown.
He's not getting up, Jim.
He's not getting up. No, he's been knocked out.
It's over. Mamma mia, he's done it. Anthony Joshua defeats Vladimir Klitschko. AJ does it in style.
Beaten down, hopeless, without an answer, and Lomachenko has made Rigondeaux quit.
It's Fisgionados with Evan Rutkowski.
He's a good boy, you know.
Hello, fight fans. It is Thursday, October 10th, and this is the Fisgionados podcast on the Leave It in the Ring radio network. I'm your host, Evan Rutkowski, former HBO sports marketing executive, giving you my take on what's happening in the sport of boxing on your screen and behind the scenes. Email is at fistinatos@yahoo.com. Follow me on Twitter at fistinatospod. We are brought to you by Ring Magazine and ringtv.com. All right, couple things before we start this episode. First of all, and most importantly, I was planning on recording this last night. I didn't just because I did not get any information relating to Showtime's show on Saturday night in terms of what the TV ratings were. It did not crack the top 150 shows on cable. And obviously there were a lot of other things going on with that show, but I did not record last night. In some ways, I guess it's good that I didn't. The Errol Spence news this morning will affect in some ways the deep dive, and I'll go into that before I get there. But, obviously I was going to go over, and I still am going to go over the ramifications of the pay-per-view. I will do it in as much of a context respectful to Errol Spence as possible from the news that he was in a car accident. And we don't know what his next, first of all, we're just happy that it appears that he's okay, but we have no idea what kind of injuries he has at this time and whether or not he's going to be able to continue boxing. I'm still going to review. A lot of what I was planning on talking about with you guys had nothing to do with that. It was just sort of the ramifications of, in terms of the going forward stuff, I will couch that where appropriate. On a less somber note, thank you for all the response from my last episode. I thought I did a good job just sort of on the how do you grow. I was so proud of this deep dive on how you grow the sport. And not many people cared about that. I got more response than ever just on the 5-minute rant I went on ESPN's tech. So I guess good to know that people care about that. And I am not the only one with those frustrations. But fun stuff. Let's jump into it. Let's go into the review section. All right. From 2 weeks ago on Friday, September 27th from London on ESPN Plus, we have Daniel Dubois winning by KO/1 over Ebenezer Tete. Not much to say about that. Thank you, Daniel, for making it quick. Then on Saturday, September 28th from LA on Fox pay-per-view, we have Errol Spence Jr. winning by split decision over Sean Porter in a fantastic welterweight fight to unify the WBC and IBF titles. As I said above, this is going to be the subject from the deep dive. I'm going to leave this alone until we get through the rest of the review section and come back to it. So we'll just go over the undercard here. In the undercard, we have David Benavidez beating Anthony Durrell and winning Durrell's WBC super middleweight title by KO9. Mario Barrios beating Batir Akhmedov for a vacant WBA regular junior welterweight title in a controversial close but unanimous decision. And then Josecito Lopez winning by KO8 against John Molina Jr., who retired in the days after the fight. Let's start with Benavidez. He looked tentative early, but then became very dominant as the fight moved on. Now, he's supposed to take of his mandatory, though who knows what will happen there, because apparently his mandatory failed a couple drug tests. Everyone expects a lower level defense, ideally the mandatory, whoever that ends up being, followed by a bigger fight in terms of how the next 6 to 9 months are looking for Benavidez. He's obviously one of the top, not just prospects anymore in the sport, but he's one of the top fighters in the sport. He's certainly an incredible, talent at 168. Anthony Durrell was competitive early and apparently had talked about retiring in the week leading up to the fight. I think he took an unnecessary beating in the last few rounds, and mostly because of that nasty eye cut. In terms of his career, he's maximized his talent. I mean, if you would have said 10 years ago that he was going to have a far better career than his brother, like, you'd have been laughed out of the room. But that's exactly what happened. And look, it's not to minimize the issues that his brother had. It's just more to talk about how great Anthony Durrell's career has been. And I would love it if this was it for him. If he had one more fight for big money, I would totally get it. But, you know, he's staring at the end of the line. Bigger picture, this is a fun TV fight in division that only 12 to 18 months ago was kind of heading nowhere, but you got to credit both the PBC and the World Boxing Super Series for building up a couple of exciting and impressive fighters. You know, Benavidez could end up being a true star. I mean, you can see a pathway for him winning some big fights at 168, moving up and having a lot of opponents at 175 as well. You know, it's an exciting division now with a lot of depth, and we're going to see a lot of the best fights over the next year or so just play out, probably on regular Fox and DAZN, which is good news for fight fans. Okay, let's go to the controversy. Batir Ekhmedov probably should have won the fight against Mario Barrios. There was a crazy punch count difference, and more importantly than that, it just felt like there weren't many swing rounds in this fight. I can't say I scored it perfectly, but I had Ekhmedov winning. Either way, you can make a very strong argument that the knockdown at the end of the fight was a three-point swing and a draw, or a slight victory either way was reasonable. Anytime there's two knockdowns like that, especially in rounds that probably would have gone the other way, it is tough. So I think it's right to have a controversy. I don't know if it's right to call it like an absolute robbery. And Ekhmedov has to take some of the blame for that. I mean, the crazy thing here is with the scores that came in, he would have lost the fight even had that last knockdown not happened. And that's just very highly questionable. I mean, again, it's probably in the eyebrow raise category, but not like stop the presses, let's investigate corruption. Barrios did win a couple rounds early on, clearly. He scored two knockdowns, and it wasn't just a couple rounds. I mean, he won several rounds out of the first six, like, pretty clearly. I would like to see both of these guys in the future. I mean, if there's a rematch, you'd have to think Ekhmedov would win comfortably if he can get his knockdown issues taken care of. Moving on to the first fight on the card, I mean, I don't have much to say about this except thank you, John Molina Jr., for the years of entertaining fights you gave us. I wish you well in retirement. And then Josecito Lopez, if this isn't your final opportunity, it's one of the last ones you're going to get, so let's see what you got. You know, great performance, but, you know, let's see it against a guy who's not about to retire coming next. So whatever's next for you, I'm watching. I like you, Josecito Lopez. Moving on. On Saturday, October 5th, from New York on DAZN, in addition to the Fight of the Year candidate we had from, you know, with Spence Porter on the 28th, we have another Fight of the Year candidate with Gennady Golovkin beating Sergey Derevyanchenko by a very close unanimous decision for the vacant IBF middleweight title. The rest of the card was a complete joke, with almost all the undercard fighters winning by complete mismatch KOs. And I'm not even going to bother listing the results here, even though that I'll say there are some really good fighters who are on the card, but just complete mismatches. Let's start by looking at the Triple G fight, though, and let's just go into that. It's kind of a mini deep dive, I guess. Triple G is getting old right before our eyes. I mean, he's 37. He's clearly lost some of the athleticism that was so key in building him up. You know, I know there was rumors he had a bad cold or he had the flu. Like, that's something. The last time he had a cold or he had the flu, like, Billy Briscoe literally had to stop the fight because he thought Gabe Rosado was going to die in the ring. You know, Triple G, you know, maybe this one was worse, but you shouldn't be giving those excuses. Triple G, and the other part, I mean, there are a few people who have talked about his career. You know, he shouldn't be training at altitude this much, or it's Jonathan Banks' fault. I think he's just getting old, and I wouldn't have switched from Abel Sanchez. I mean, you can make an argument that Sanchez has cost him tactically in the Canelo fights, but look, Canelo has proven himself to be a great, if not, you know, this is a subject for a different day, but Canelo wasn't regarded as someone who had pound for pound number one capability when he was fighting as a prospect. And you can literally put him in that place right now. I mean, I don't know that I would. I mean, I kind of think all that stuff is nonsense, but if he isn't in your top five, just based on resume, then you got to rethink your top five, you know, certainly top 10. I mean, his resume is incredibly impressive. Anyways, I think this is Triple G. I mean, Triple G is 37, like, and his power was explosive, and that requires really explosive athleticism. And, you know, when you're a power fighter and when you're a pressure fighter, typically that doesn't age well. And I know that there's ways of looking at him like, oh, he can resort back to the jab and everything. He's been training for years this way through Abel Sanchez and the altitude training too. I mean, that's not something I think is a long-term pathway for success. I think it worked well for him at a certain point, but you know, now you're in a different phase of your career. I mean, I actually thought going into the fight that Triple G would control Derevchenko with the strong jab and with his ability to cut off the ring. When Derevchenko moved forward, like, Triple G could land power shots and he could probably knock him out. And I mean, some of that was based on me underestimating the performance against Steve Rolls, where Triple G just didn't quite look that good, to be perfectly honest. Some of that was looking at Derevchenko's last performance against Jack Colquay, where he didn't look great. But I think you come in, you look at this fight on the whole. Look, fight of the year contender for sure. Probably my fight of the year. I mean, but I think this one and Spence Porter, you can both in the same category. I mean, they're neck and neck right now. You know, I'm probably just saying that because this one was the more recent one. If this one would have come first and Spence Porter would have come second, I'd probably say that one. I'd have to give it a little bit more time to think about it. Derevchenko, you got to give him a lot of credit. Like, instead of this being a stylistic nightmare for him, it was quite the opposite. It was the stylistic nightmare for Triple G. You can actually make an argument that the cut over his eye actually helped him because it just forced him to continue forward with that smothering style. I think if you were, you know, scoring it 114-113 either way is probably a legit score. I mean, a lot of people scored it towards Derevchenko. I think you could have given it to Triple G 115-112. I think all those kind of fight, you know, scores would have been legit. There were a lot of swing rounds, but you know, if you go back, I think once you get into the 116-111, I think that's where either way, that's where you're off. It's a great fight. I mean, some of the big takeaways, if you're DAZN right now, you have to be worried. Like, this is two fights in with Triple G, and if you don't match him up against Canelo next, like, you probably spent way too much money on Triple G at this part of his career. And so, you know, what does happen next? A lot of people are calling for a rematch. You got to remember, this was a weird IBF mandatory situation where there is a set percentage of the purse that goes to the challenger. Credit Lou DiBella and Keith Connolly and Al Haymon. Remember, Al Haymon is involved in Sergey Derevchenko, so Al Haymon is involved now in a fight that happened, you know, a crossover fight happening on DAZN. We can't see, you know, a lot of people out there saying, oh, it's only Top Rank doing it. Nope, this is Al Haymon. Credit, I think DiBella and Connolly are really the people in this case that exploited that loophole with the IBF. And that's from talking with people behind the scenes. Obviously, there was a great story about it from Pugmire. They got Derevchenko a huge payday in excess of $5 million for the fight. And that's because of that set percentage. Triple G has a huge guaranteed payday coming for him. It's DAZN, so it's not pay-per-view. It's not a percentage of the pay-per-view. And, you know, he just has a flat fee coming his way. And Derevchenko made a lot of money because what that means, though, is there's less leverage on Derevchenko's side to get a high purse in a rematch because there's no longer the guarantee from the IBF that the B side is going to get, I think, 35% of the purse. So now you just have to make the fight. There's no way that they'd pay Derevchenko $5 million to come back and do it again. They'd probably pay him a couple million bucks. He gave a great effort. PBC could also bring Derevchenko over to their side of the street. They could have him fight Charlo. And, you know, I think that would be a big fight just finally because you're giving Charlo a meaningful opponent. You know, he's sitting there with a sort of weird, you know, non-legitimate version of the WBC title. So you can actually make it so it's a title fight. You can probably give Derevchenko a comeback fight and actually, you know, Charlo's not really fighting a meaningful opponent on December 7th. Probably do, like, this is actually the first meaningful opponent of his career at 160 pounds for sure, and might even be the most meaningful opponent of his career, period. So, you know, look, I actually think the best stylistic matchup, if you didn't want to do that on the PBC side, you know, because quite frankly, I think once that's over, you're still in that position where all the other middleweights are back over on DAZN. I actually think the best stylistic matchup would be Derevchenko versus Andrade. I think, you know, you talk about Derevchenko with that smothering style. If he could do that versus Andrade, I mean, that is going to be, you know, that works out well for a lot of people because Andrade's been in boring fights, quite frankly. And if Andrade can just clearly beat Derevchenko, then he's, you know, that is a huge, I mean, that is by far his best win of his career and probably makes it a really good fight. I mean, if that ends up being a boring fight, then Andrade is just way more of a talent than anyone has seen in the ring thus far. And if not, it's his first opportunity to be in a really great, entertaining TV fight. You know, if I'm DAZN, you need to take a serious look at making Triple G versus Munguia or Andre next. And I know that Triple G, they brought in the Polish fighter. You know, there's now talk that he might be the mandatory Kamil Zeremeta coming up. And if Triple G wants to take care of his IBF mandatory, and he wants to do it in the first quarter, especially if it's January, February of 2020, I think I'm actually okay with that. I mean, that's clearly Triple G would be heavily favored in that, and you're not psyched about giving out a huge payday, but if the belt is that important to make, you know, for Canelo to make the Triple G fight, you have to look at that as the best way for you to gain subscribers, and that means that, if he wins that mandatory and Canelo's willing to fight him in May, yeah, it's all worth it. Have him fight the mandatory. Have him take care of that mandatory and then, you know, put him up against the big fights. You can actually, if his athleticism is truly declining in the way that this is and Canelo beats him, you know, you have one more fight on the contract and you could put him in against Andrade or any of these other guys that will now have an opportunity to win a really meaningful fight against Triple G. That could be great. Munguia, another, you know, if Canelo doesn't want to fight him, you can have Triple G fight Munguia or Andre, quite frankly, next, and just guarantee you'd have to set it up so that Canelo automatically fights the winner of either Triple G versus Munguia or Triple G versus Andre. If you really wanted to be, I mean, I think I'd favor Triple G versus Munguia, like, pretty heavily at this point, and that is a big-time commercial fight just based on Munguia's fan base. You can, even if that's not the Cinco de Mayo fight, you can put that in May or June and set up the Canelo versus the winner in September. If it's Triple G versus Andrade, I probably, at this point, I mean, God, I would have, before this performance by Triple G, I would have favored Triple G ever so slightly, but fairly significant, like maybe in the 2-1 type of odds range. I think after this performance, I'd probably slightly favor Andrade. I think Triple G still represents some stylistic, you know, especially if he does change trainers, which is the rumor now. I think he does represent some stylistic challenges for Andrade. Andrade clearly represents some stylistic challenges for Triple G at this point, though, as well. It's really interesting. And you can do a lot with it if you're DAZN, but you have to build to the big significant fights. And I think that's what you need to do. If you're DAZN, you have an opportunity to make several big fights in this division in the first quarter or first half of 2020. And you can probably get relative clarity in the division by September or October of 2020. I think that will actually tremendously benefit you in terms of subscriber base. Really important to do that. I mean, and again, going back to PBC here, it's really two pathways. Like I said, you can build Derevchenko and Trello to fight each other, which is really just a comeback fight for Derevchenko, maybe another meh sort of fight for Charlo. You could also try it to execute a high-stakes network trade. I mean, Charlo, right now, especially even if Charlo wins, I mean, you've got to start taking a look at matching up Charlo against whoever comes out of this DAZN side of things. you know, and there's several possibilities here. I mean, you've got Tank Davis and Charlo both who, you know, quite frankly, like don't have important fights in their division right now on the PBC side of things. I mean, yes, you can say Derevchenko and Charlo can fight, but that's one fight. You can't build that. That's not a fight you can build with three or four building fights to that. I mean, that's a fight you'd have to do relatively soon. There's a lot of similarities here with a lot of issues for PBC. It's, you know, similarities to, quite frankly, what they're doing in the welterweight division. You know, it's very interesting. I think you have to take a look at both options. But going back to it, I think if you're a DAZN exec, again, there's a real roadmap to have a 12 to 18 month plan to figuring out the real middleweight kingpin. There's, with Canelo moving up two weight classes, it does speak volumes for Canelo and his abilities, his dare to be great attitude, but it's sort of ad hoc in terms of just making fights. There's no articulation of a real plan to get clarification, and I think if DAZN does a great job of doing that instead of just making ad hoc fights, it'll really affect their subscriber base. I think people will subscribe if they know that, hey, I can subscribe here for $99 a year, and in the next year or two, I'm going to see a lot of these big fights, and there's going to get, you know, we're going to see clarification. Okay, a few quick notes before we move on. In terms of the broadcast, let's go over the good and bad. I think Sergio Mora is really talented in terms, you know, as an analyst. He did not have a good night here. He made a mistake with Baranchuk early on. He's, you know, sort of not realizing he was a former champ at 140. And then we've seen, this has come out at times, some of his stubbornness has come out where he either drives the same point home too much or he takes a side early on in the fight and then isn't willing to have the intellectual flexibility to properly give credence to what is happening in the ring after he takes that side. I mean, just to be clear, I think he's really smart. I think he's really talented and I think he can overcome these things. But you can definitely, this overly stubborn mental sort of lack of flexibility, you can see it on certain issues. And when he talks longer in longer spurts, you can definitely see it, you know, when he's not talking on the broadcast, like sometimes, you know, when you hear him as a guest on a podcast or something like that. I hope he can break these habits. He is a very smart analyst. I think I do want to emphasize that. You know, on the bright side, I think credit is due for the DAZN team. They just completely trashed the undercard fights like Larry Merchant style on the air, and rightfully so. You don't see that from pretty much anywhere else. I mean, even, you don't even really see a lot of that from Showtime's crew, who has certainly had the opportunities to do that in 2019. You know, I really enjoyed the sections where Chris Mannix was speaking with Mike Coppinger and Keith Idek, sort of filling time in between fights. Those segments added a lot to the main event. They really built it up. They sort of explained the circumstances more. You know, for core fans that don't have time to listen to five podcasts a week about the inside elements of boxing, like, those segments can add a lot of meaning to what you're about to see. And obviously here, they had time to do it. There was plenty of just sort of crap undercard fights, and there were plenty of times on the broadcast to iron out the kinks and get some reps in by doing it. So hopefully we'll see more of that moving forward. I thought both Coppinger and Idek are excellent candidates for this. I'd love to see Pugmire in there next time. A note before we move on, you know, I try to stay relatively positive on this stuff in terms of boxing. Occasionally I break down and get really negative. Flint, Michigan. All right. The Clarissa Shields, Ivana Habazine thing. Look, I'm not going to get into the details of what happened here. Obviously the bottom line is we have, a trainer who was sent to the hospital and then had to go back into the hospital because of a brain bleed. We had Clarissa Shields missing out on a $500,000 payday. I mean, this is boxing. I'm not going to sit here and come down from Mount Pius and say, oh, this, she needs to do this or somebody needs to do that. I will say, like, when it affects, those are two material things that are really affected. Obviously, someone's health was affected by this, and obviously someone's wallet was affected by this sort of interaction. I don't know enough about it to comment on it. And there has been some information that's come out on it, but we miss seeing this. And you know, we missed seeing the fight. The other fights on the card weren't that great. Obviously, it created a lot of noise, but it didn't help the card at all. Part of the reason why I didn't record till lunchtime on Thursday was because this show did not make the top 150 cable shows. It was not highly watched, obviously. You know, Jaron Ennis had a great fight. You know, other than that, there wasn't too much on to care about. I don't know what to say here. I'm not going to say that Clarissa Shields needs to make changes yet. I think there's a lot of issues with finding opponents for her. And I think it is a credit to Showtime that they're featuring her. I do like that about what Showtime is doing. It's one of the bright spots that they have picked someone like her. But look, this is significant. I think everyone needs to take a step back and think about what you can do moving forward and making some changes here, because this kind of stuff can't continue. No one wants to miss out on these kind of paydays, and no one wants people going to the hospital, especially with brain bleeds. And that it doesn't excuse what happened in there. But again, this is boxing. I'm not coming down from Mount Pius to talk about those types of issues. All right, on to the deep dive. We're going to look at the pay-per-view results from September 28th. We are going to look at what it all means, maybe even talk a little bit about the TV broadcast as well. Like I said from the top, I didn't record this Wednesday because I wanted to wait till Thursday at lunch to figure out what Showtime's ratings were. Obviously, in light of the news of Errol Spence, I'm going to say before we even begin to talk about the ramifications, thoughts, prayers, hopes, good vibes, whatever it is you do, please do them right now for Errol Spence. At the very moment I'm recording, all I know is that he was in a single car crash early in the morning, on Thursday morning. There has been some reporting from local people in Dallas that seem to indicate that he is going to be okay, might have some broken teeth, could possibly be charged with the DWI. Could is the key word there. I don't think that's super relevant, to be perfectly honest, you know, to his boxing career as it stands right now. All I know is I hope he's okay. I hope he continues with his career. I think the first or second episode I ever did was on the progression of his career. I've always thought he's a generational talent. You know, I really would love to see him in the ring again. If not, I'm very happy for him that his last two fights have provided him with the financial security of multi-million dollar paydays. Hopefully those two paydays, along with what I'm assuming have been a couple, either around $1 million or certainly high six-figure paydays, will have set him up so he can enjoy the rest of his life, at least from a financial security sense. This deep dive is really an analysis of the entire pay-per-view process, so I'll go with it and really only make minor edits. Quite frankly, like, as I wade into the territories that I was, you know, planning on discussing certain things, and obviously some of that stuff has changed because of the accident, but I'll be upfront about which parts. Yeah, I was going to talk about this. Now we're going to talk about this. I try to be cautiously optimistic, sort of, I guess, I don't know if this is a hedge or not. I try to be a cautiously optimistic realist when it comes to boxing and when it comes to life. So at least right now, out of respect for Spence's talent, I'm going to talk about these issues, assuming there's a pathway to him resuming his career at a very high level. Okay, back to the pay-per-view. First things first, Errol Spence defeated Sean Porter by split decision to win the fight. Just in terms of the fight itself, I thought it was a fight of the year candidate, if not the leading candidate. And like I said from the top, this other fight from October 5th with Golovkin and Derevchenko, I mean, these two for me are neck and neck for fight of the year. I think you probably, just because of the impact, you still have to consider Joshua versus Ruiz as a fight of the year, just in terms of meaning. Maybe it wasn't as good in the ring as these fights, but in terms of what the meaning was, I don't want to make this about fight of the year candidates, but those are the three that come to mind that really break through. But anyways, going back to this one, both fighters really come out of it being the clear defining fight of their respective careers thus far. I think just in terms of how we're about to look at, like, the out of the ring ramifications, like, we just got to say that, like, no matter what, as of right now, This is the defining fight of Sean Porter's career. This is the defining fight of Errol Spence's career. Shout out to my guy, Johnny Wilds. I watched the fight with him and his wife, Lisa. They definitely know how to do a spread for the fight. We had a wonderful time eating. And we watched it together. We weren't really scoring it. When you do look at the scores, like, we were kind of keeping score. I think 114, 113 either way, or 115 to 112 for Spence are all very understandable scores. I think I could even see it 116 to 111 for Spence, but you're sort of giving him every benefit of the doubt if you give him that kind of score. Porter, I think, and this is really the most notable thing, is Porter dictated the pace of the fight. But it's tough to say he won the fight, though it was very close. I definitely think there were, you could score it in Porter's favor and have a legit scorecard. Let's get to the business side, though. That's, I think, why most people are listening to this. This was the second time we've seen Fox whip out the real bazooka, and it's the first time we've seen it by the NFL. And by my calculations, we're going to do between 250 and 270,000, 275,000 buys. They're going to over-index on digital buys. They're going to do pretty well on cable buys. They're going to do really poorly on all satellite results, which is DirecTV and Dish. And we'll get into that stuff in a bit. Going into this, and as I'm saying this and getting more information, probably closer to 250 than 275, but I'm just trying to be as accurate as possible when I say that. Going into this, I don't think the stakes could have been higher in terms of the outcome, like determining what kind of fights are going to happen in the future. Like, here's why. Had this fight done under 200,000 buys, PBC's and Spence's options would have been quite limited going into 2020. You know, I've gone over this on the pod before. I'm not at all confident that PBC is making money on the Pacquiao pay-per-view fights that they've done. And quite frankly, I think that's being generous. Like, they're probably losing a couple million dollars, even in this new Fox world, which is clearly better for PBC. Promoters will take chances on pay-per-view, but if the guarantees are high enough, like, you know, they're going to lose money on them. And in fact, like, pay-per-view historically should be where promoters make a lot of their money, not lose money. But, you know, even in building on my last episode, like, when you look at the percentage of a promoter's revenue that goes to a fighter, like, pay-per-view is critical. I don't want to get sidetracked on that, but we will come back to that. But had this done under 200,000 buys, PBC had really sort of three options for Spence. Like, either one, he just gets Manny Pacquiao, and PBC overpays to do it, to get Pac in there, which probably means a huge payday for Pacquiao. And then they sort of cross their fingers and hopes it does like 750,000 to a million pay-per-view buys. And I don't think it would do that. They could also put Spence back on regular Fox and maybe just sort of have him take care of a mandatory or something like that. I mean, he has the IBF title. Obviously, he took care of Ocampo a while ago, but you never know with the IBF. And you just sort of hope that that does a good rating, and in a fight or two, you can do a pay-per-view against sort of a Thurman or a Garcia, or and just kind of hope it works out, and eventually it does get over 200,000 buys. Or you could put him in against Crawford much earlier than you want it, because that's the safest bet to make a profitable pay-per-view in this environment. Like, maybe you could even do that after a fight on Fox, but there's not a whole lot of chess moves on the table if this fight doesn't do 200,000 buys. Obviously, knowing what we know about the car accident, all this stuff is going to get delayed, but I want to emphasize that these were the stakes sort of heading into this. And I think let's start by looking at like what this purely means from a PBC perspective, because I think that's where we'll feel the most impact. I mean, there's a few notable elements to this, and I think all of them are pretty favorable to the PBC, ranging from things that are just sort of like complete home runs to just sort of really solid developments. And then there's also those kind of disaster aversions. And so first things first, like I mentioned above, PBC, by my calculations, which are not everyone's, let's be real on that, PBC is going to make money on this pay-per-view. Why is that significant? Well, I think the only other show that made money, the only other pay-per-view show that made money in 2019 was the Spence Garcia fight in March. And there have been pay-per-views in January, March, April, June, now September. There's almost going to be certainly one in November that's going to lose money. So that's six pay-per-views in 2019. Only two of them will have been profitable overall. And let's just start by congratulating PBC by putting on a profitable show and by mentioning that Errol Spence is the only fighter to be in profitable pay-per-views in 2019. Like, that's where we are in boxing right now. I'm pretty confident that only two of them are going to make money. And Errol Spence, maybe he wasn't the financial A-side of Mikey Garcia, but he was the A-side in both of them. You know, well, why is that significant? Well, PBC actually developed him through an internal process rather than signing him as a free agent. And one of the things that spoke volumes for this pay-per-view was the salaries, both the reported salaries to the California State Athletic Commission and then the rumored guarantees. You know, both fighters had reported salaries of only $2 million to the California State Athletic Commission. And obviously what they report to the state does not have to be accurate. The actual fighter guarantee, supposedly the rumors are that Porter got $4 million. I've heard two numbers for Spence, one being $6 million, one being $8 million. If you contrast that with Pacquiao, who is supposedly getting guarantees in excess of $20 million, Thurman supposedly got a guarantee in excess of $7 million for that Pacquiao-Thurman fight. Like, you're now actually seeing some fiscal responsibility with these events in terms of fighter salaries. And one of the things I've been talking about a lot on this podcast is the shift to the pay-per-view universe. You know, that where Fox has sort of taken control here, and I've been talking about the splits and how that whole thing has worked. But one of the things I probably haven't emphasized is another major change in the pay-per-view system in the past. And look, this wasn't the case for every pay-per-view, but it was how a lot of them worked. HBO or Showtime would sign a fighter to an exclusive contract, because remember, in those days, you know, it wasn't just one promoter or content provider that had the exclusive deals with the networks. So let's just look at Mayweather. When Showtime signed him to a very rich deal, they were on the hook for $30 million guaranteed to Mayweather no matter what kind of business the pay-per-view actually did. And Fox is not doing that, which puts the onus on the content provider, which in this case is the PBC, to take the financial risk. Why is that important? Well, assuming PBC cares whether they make money on these events, like, the events need to be profitable for them to be sustainable. And trust me, like, every other content provider or promoter will care deeply about whether these events are profitable. I think PBC does too, though you do have the added twists of maybe they have whatever's left of the Waddell and Reed money, plus the other business model for PBC, which is where they take a percentage of the fighter pay, which is usually around 15%, though that's definitely not the standard. You know, some fighters they don't take anything from. You know, I'm not even sure. Maybe some fighters they take more from. I doubt it. But look, as a fan, you have every right to say, what do I care whether they make money or not on it? You know, and I don't really care if PBC is going to just drain some money from some rich people. Like, I don't really care. And look, you're correct. As long as the money's there, I've said a lot of times, I care a lot more about what the fighters are making as opposed to like what some hedge fund guys are making or whatever. But this does need to be a sustainable business model or you just won't see it continue. And I don't know how much longer we're going to see money losing pay-per-views coming from any side, even with all the money that's coming into boxing right now. Getting back to the overall point, it's pretty significant that Fox isn't risking anything in this equation because it means they love putting on these pay-per-views. They'll put them on all day long. And all they're really doing is shifting marketing support from PBC on regular Fox, or maybe to PBC's credit, maybe they're shifting some marketing support that would have gone to other sports, and they're just moving it to support pay-per-view. So they get a cut of the revenue from all the pay-per-view sales without actually putting up any money. It's a huge win for them. It's a dramatic shift from the HBO Showtime days. And like I said, not every HBO Showtime pay-per-view is like that. But, you know, many times HBO and Showtime actually face some major risks if they had a fighter signed to a contract. And what does it all mean? I mean, it just means if you're Fox, you don't care who's fighting. You encourage the bigger names to fight, and you don't care whether the fight actually makes a profit. You just want pay-per-view sales, you know, and to their credit, if they were able to use this marketing support to develop a star in the vein of a Floyd Mayweather who could fight twice a year and get a million pay-per-view buys each time they fought, like just those two fights alone could probably pay for almost half the entire PBC contract for that year, which is just crazy because pay-per-view was never looked upon as something that could fund a contract like that in the past. Basically, HBO and Showtime were too afraid of worsening their relationships with cable providers because as a whole company, not as a sports department, they depended on the cable companies so much to deliver them those monthly subscription fees that came from so many people subscribing to HBO and Showtime. You know, that is a significant development. It is a little bit of a tangent. Let's get back to the other positives for the PBC here. But I don't even mean it in a you know, sort of snarky way. Like, let's just congratulate PBC for putting on a profitable pay-per-view. Why is it important? Because clearly, you know, they've cleared that apparently not that low bar in 2019 of being profitable and sustainable when they put on a pay-per-view like this. And we've gone over why Fox is so gung-ho about supporting it. It's, I think, what isn't talked about enough here, and this is talked about in other sports all the time. Like, this is the equivalent of developing third through seventh round draft picks in the NFL. It's the equivalent of having a stacked minor league baseball, sort of group of prospects. It's the equivalent of Moneyball. And I mean, it's just so important to develop your own internal fighters to get to pay-per-view. And here's a closer look as to why. I mean, this, and this, I'm like, if Spence recovers from his injury, like, this could be Spence, but it could also be any of the other PBC fighters that break out. It could be David Benavidez, for that matter. Everyone is sitting here. The main talking point, especially before the car accident, was how PBC can freeze out Crawford. And that's important, but that's more of like a PR importance. Like, there's a lot of other layers to this and why it's important to develop and keep your own fighters. I mean, you know, even if PBC controls all the welterweights besides Crawford, if none of them develop into a pay-per-view fighter who can clear that 200,000 buy rate as their own on an A-side, like, none of this matters. If it's just them fighting, you know, against an overmatched B-side and regular Fox, yeah, you're freezing out Crawford, but you're doing it at a tremendous cost to yourself because you're using valuable slots on Fox to feature fighters who aren't, you know, developing. They're not really getting great paydays. They're getting good paydays, but they're not really getting great paydays, and they're not developing and making bigger fights. You know, I talked a lot about this last year on the show, but the whole point of controlling a weight class is to actually develop a pay-per-view fighter, because that means that not only are you going to get, so when you put on a pay-per-view fight, let's just look at what happens when, and let's use Spence Porter as the example here. You're also giving other guys in PBC, first of all, you're giving other guys in the same weight class paydays that are bigger than you normally get on a Fox, on a regular TV deal. And that opens up slots for other fighters. Like, this is actually real trickle-down economics in a real way, like, not the political fake talking point. Like, if you're PBC developing Spence or any other welterweight as a pay-per-view attraction for just one card, that means that not only Spence is getting significantly more money by fighting on pay-per-view in a sustainable way, but his opponent, Sean Porter, is as well. And you got paydays for six other undercard fighters, and in this case, two of them made $1 million, or at least that's what they reported to the California State Athletic Commission in Durrell and Benavidez. And then you also open up one, if not two, slots for other fighters, because Spence Porter would have been on regular Fox, and now it's on pay-per-view. So now that regular Fox has two slots opened up for fighters besides Spence and Porter. You're basically getting Porter paid. You know, if we look at Spence as the financial A side, you're basically getting Porter paid $4 million instead of $1 million as a B side for a big fight, or an A side, you know, on a regular Fox show against, you know, basically a no-hoper. And I shouldn't say no-hoper. The Ugas fight was really well-matched, but you'd have to think if he goes back on again, he's probably not fighting someone as good as Ugas. And it's not to say that I don't think PBC should put a fight like Spence versus Porter on regular Fox instead of pay-per-view, because I definitely think they should. Maybe not that specific fight. The economics of it are now proven that that's sustainable. So that's huge. But it goes, I think my overall point here is it goes way further than just that talked about narrative that, oh, now PBC can dictate the terms of the eventual Spence Crawford fight. I mean, they can, and that does matter in terms of the narrative of that fight, and maybe a little bit in terms of the total financial impact. of the first fight. I think with the second fight, it's really whoever wins is going to be the A side, assuming they fight more than once. But I think it's just more, it's way more important in terms of PBC to have a sustainable, profitable model than it is of getting an extra 5 or 8% on the split that happens with Spence versus Crawford. I mean, it's important for you to go around and say on the management wing of your business that you can properly dictate sort of these terms. But for every example like this where you can with Spence and Crawford, look, you're not going to be able to with Charlo. You're not going to be able to with Tank Davis. So, you know, that's a tough argument. I think it's just it goes back to how many extra slots and extra paydays open up when you develop internally, not by signing as a free agent. Because Pacquiao, they signed as a free agent, and he's overpaid. So yes, you're guaranteeing other people paydays, and you're doing all those things. But if you're losing money doing that, I don't know that it's really worth it. Like, the whole point at the end of the day by developing a pay-per-view star is, especially if you do it internally, as they continue to become more profitable, they share in that, and they need to really be commercially established before you pay them a big commercial payday. Okay, let's wrap up a few other parts of this. I don't know if you guys caught that, but my phone, Siri jumping on my phone notwithstanding. In terms of the actual pay-per-view number, there is a lot of arguing going on behind the scenes of what the actual pay-per-view numbers are going to be for this. Like I said from the top, I think it'll end up being closer to 250, but it's going to be in the 250-275 range. I've also heard from a few different people who track this thing, it'll be closer to 200. You know, some of the people even say slightly less. Obviously, there are initial numbers that point much higher. Here's a few things to remember. First, in terms of trends, and I'm speaking in generalities here, like I said up top, digital trended well, satellite trended poorly, cable trended pretty good. Anyone who can tell you they know an actual number in the few days after a fight is lying, but they can point to indicators and they can model these things out. But one of the points I've been making all summer long here is that the models that people were using even a year or two ago, they're just not applicable anymore. The people, like, for instance, in this case, when you look at the numbers that are coming in from DirecTV and Dish, I've heard several different numbers, all of them in the 45,000 to 55,000 range. For DirecTV, Dish, I've heard, is being terrible. Well, those are really low, and those used to, and DirecTV used to make up somewhere between 40 and 50% of the total buys in some respects. You know, or you could model it out based on a not even that complicated formula that's how important DirecTV was. But look, DirecTV used to be a behemoth in the sporting world, and it's now basically reduced to a complete dumpster fire. It's a train wreck there at DirecTV. And it's not just with regards to pay-per-view. I mean, DirecTV went from, I believe, 24 million subscribers. It's now at 17. And a lot of those were, a lot of people are sports fans who subscribe to DirecTV because they had the NFL Sunday ticket. So as that atrophy happens, if those are the people who are switching to cord cutters and buying the pay-per-view through digital, digital is much more important. Because remember, a digital buy in this universe in most cases probably equals almost two buys through cable or satellite systems. So it's really important to get digital correct here. And I think digital is important as well because you get immediate indicators from digital that you can't get anywhere else. I mean, I can tell you I've worked on, I have now worked on a music pay-per-view, and you can see digital buys that night. You can see them basically almost in real time with basically a very slight delay. So you can get immediate indicators from digital. I'm sure Fox had immediate indicators from digital. They were probably very happy with it. It is tough here. Again, it is very tough to model this out because what was previously easy to determine based on a DirecTV number, and maybe I'm wrong. I think the formula might not. Maybe it's not even that. Basically, the percentages now are completely skewed. They're completely skewed from what they used to be, and that's because this whole television world has, it's become a lot more disparate. It used to just be between the in-demand number and between the DirecTV number, it was just so easy to predict what the actual number was. You could do it literally by Monday. you could get DirecTV numbers on Sunday or Monday, and by Monday night you could probably model it all out. Now, a lot of times it can take 6 weeks to get numbers from in-demand. I mean, you can get trends early on, but, you know, remember, there are dozens. I mean, there are basically hundreds of smaller cable operators, systems throughout this country, and you don't know how to count all those. It takes weeks. So that boring explanation notwithstanding, just, you know, remember, there can be a lot of arguing over what the real number is, but I don't really think that's important right now, because especially when you consider how important digital is and how you need to build that up, let's focus on the actions here, because I think the actions of PVC speak louder than words in terms of a number. So Danny Garcia was going to get the next fight against Spence, and they were going to do it in January. And remember, Pacquiao fought in January last year, so he could have been the opponent based on his Senate schedule, but it's not going to be Pacquiao. That means that the pay-per-view did not do crazy great numbers. It probably didn't get over that 300,000 buy threshold that would have meant that the world is Spence's oyster, you know, and he could have gone for the Pacquiao fight, and you could probably justify overpaying Pacquiao to do the fight. But we also, you know, that's the negative part of it. The positive part is we didn't see a deliberation period. Like, we saw the fight announced in the ring. We saw the date given soon after, which means that the pay-per-view did make money. And they didn't need to take a step back and figure out the strategy for next time. They didn't need to go put Spence back on regular Fox. You know, they would have had NFL playoffs to promote the next one if the numbers kept increasing. Like, if he does 300,000 or more for the next one, well, Spence is going to become a business to himself. And I think it's encouraging that we were going to see him in January for a quick turnaround. I mean, obviously, now we're waiting to see what happens. We're hoping for the quick recovery. We're hoping he can even get back into the ring. If Spence did want to get back into the ring, I mean, this accident and his comeback would be part of that storyline in one sense, but in a pure boxing sense, you almost have to put him back in a comeback fight, you know, maybe against a fighter who would be viewed as a mismatch, but you just kind of have to see him, how he looks in the ring after an accident like this. I mean, maybe you get out that IBF mandatory out of the way, similar to what Golovkin is doing. And, you know, again, that's me taking a very positive outlook on a fighter who is one of my favorite fighters. He might never fight again. We don't know. But again, let's move on. The world around him will move on. Pacquiao apparently has one more fight left with PBC. It's hard to see a pathway where Pacquiao and Spence fight next. If Pacquiao becomes a free agent, and I think he's being overpaid right now, I'm not confident we'll see Pacquiao as a future option for Spence unless PBC is really willing to continue overpaying him. You know, I'd say it's probably not morally right to speculate on what happens with the rest of the division until we get more news on Spence. But obviously, we are staring now at a division where Crawford is probably going to be viewed as the top guy unless Spence gets right back in and with a fight or two looks just as good as he's looked. Pacquiao is going to be the most accomplished guy. And all the PBC fighters besides Porter will be viewed as having some potential, but one of them needs to break through. I think Porter, you know, definitely, you know, he brought his A game, and I think I always thought he would be Spence's toughest test. I think he's out there and could make a great fight with just about anybody, but, you know, he is getting older as well. I don't know how many of those types of efforts he has left in him. You know, again, credit to him for his effort. There are certainly credible people who gave him the nod on the scorecards. And I think he could possibly make a commercially viable fight at pay-per-view again. I don't know whether it would be as a B-side to Crawford or it would be as, you know, a loser leaves town sort of fight against Thurman, or, you know, he certainly could make a pay-per-view fight with Pacquiao if Pacquiao did not want to fight Mikey Garcia. So we'll see. There is a world, obviously, where we're going to go back to Pacquiao being the only relevant pay-per-view A-side in the weight class. But who knows? In the most positive of outlooks for Spence, where he does resume his career, he, you know, would, you know, probably be lucky to fight even once in 2020 at this point. And there's just going to be a ton of question marks out of respect to Spence at this point. Probably not worth speculating on it anymore. A few other notes. Let's go to the broadcast. While I appreciate, actually, let's do marketing first. You know, Fox has an incredible soapbox for marketing the fight. And I think that part is amazing. I've always referred to it as the bazooka. Creatively, I do not think they did a great job. They did a good job, but they definitely, in my opinion, left buys on the table. I thought the spot was good. It was done very well, but they should be marketing Spence as boxing's next big star in the Mayweather mold. That's how they should have marketed him. If you look at their programming, I think they cheaped out on their shoulder programming a bit. There was a lot of repeat footage. There was a lot of themes that were not only repeated, but not clearly thought out to the end there. I think on the bright side, like, a lot of people actually watch these shows, which in this day and age, I'm not sure how many people watch shoulder programming. I mean, in this day and age, if you are a big fight fan, there are so many fights on the air, you probably don't care that much about shoulder programming. But when I say they cheaped out, what I really mean is what HBO did in the early days of 24/7 is they truly embedded in the camps. Like, they didn't just fly in and fly out. Like, they really got to be a fly on the wall, and they got to earn the trust of the fighters, so they got a lot more access to what was happening. It wasn't just come in for a couple days, do a couple interviews, and leave. Like, you really had a sense that you were watching A-level reality television behind the scenes, not just you were watching a journalistic interview, so to speak. And I think that's one of the significant differences here. And I also think, if you're really going to get behind a person as a personality, you need to truly embed. Like, and that didn't happen here. And you also have to remember, we're in the world of selling pay-per-views to boxing hardcore fans, like boxing's core fan base. You know, the fight in this pay-per-view world, the fight needs to be good enough that the core fight fan who already knows the sport really well is going to look at the fight and do a mental calculation as to whether the fight, and to some extent even the fight card, is worth $75 or not. For the next wave of pay-per-view fighters, and this is really whoever it's going to be, like, whoever breaks out of that is going to have to do it by force of personality. And, you know, in this, like, ethnicity does matter as well, but I don't think quite in the way that everybody thinks it does. I mean, I think it's really lazy. You know, I saw some of this, so I'll just address it. I think it's really lazy to say that Spence Porter didn't break out because it was two African-American fighters against each other. Like, it goes back to, these are still fights for core fight fans, and you need to sell the fight differently if you're going to try to expand to casual fight fans and to the general public. They're not going to buy it because, oh, it's a good fight. Like, you need to figure out how to make Errol Spence a legit crossover star. And they're starting to do the right things here. Like, he needs to tap into it a little bit better, but he needs to transcend in the same way that Mayweather did. I mean, you know, the Dallas Cowboy stuff is great. Some of the hip-hop culture stuff is great. But there needs to just be more outside of the boxing world to break through. And, I mean, look, in light of the car accident, I hate to say this, but any potential comeback in the ring would be incredibly inspiring, and it would definitely be part of his story. But even that still can't be it. That's only got to be part of it. Again, out of respect, let's not go deeper into that. But these are just my thoughts, less about what to do in the future, more about what happened in this one. We just sort of saw this fly-in, fly-out attitude, and we just sort of saw this, oh, as a journalist, tell me what's going on. We didn't truly see Errol Spence's personality in any of this kind of stuff. If you look at the last pay-per-view fights that broke through, it was really Canelo and Triple G 1 and 2, and before that it was the Mayweather fights. Even, and I think this is, I want to get away from the personality talk, sort of the cult of personality talk, but obviously in this, I'm referring to Canelo and I'm referring to Mayweather here. Even Pac Thurman, which it sort of energized a portion of Pacquiao's fan base to an extent, like, that probably isn't going to end up topping 500,000 buys when it's all said and done, which I think 500,000 buys, I'll call it the cultural breakthrough point. Like, we're in a world now where there is no pay-per-view middle class. We're either seeing Mayweather or Canelo or Conor McGregor super fights, or we're barely breaking out of the core audience. And I think a lot of that is due to the splinter nature of the TV world we live in. But a lot of that is also due to how we sell the fights. Just saying it's a unification fight, that works for regular TV. I'm not sure that works for pay-per-view. It needs to be bigger than that. And sometimes, and that needs to be a building process. It goes back to what I was saying with DAZN. And a lot of other people have talked about this too. Fights need to lead to fights. There needs to be an articulation of how this thing is progressing. It can't just be ad hoc. And part of that, I think, is all to explain why we're losing this middle class of pay-per-views. But we're now in a scenario where we have megaphones, like the NFL and Fox, like ESPN. It's critical to properly explain the stakes and breakthrough. One final note on the broadcast. I think there's some elements where we just need to see better from Fox in terms of covering the division and building to the breakthroughs. You need to mention Terrence Crawford. Like I said, know your audience. This is, like, this fight, you know, look, it's core fight fans in the audience. Just include Crawford as part of the broadcast. I think from your end, I think it's actually profitable. I mean, look, Fox and ESPN are probably going to do a pay-per-view together in February. And if it works out well, you still can do. And look, again, I'm being generous on Crawford and Spence fighting and Spence resuming his career. You can work for that kind of crossover as well. It makes sense to build up opponents and build to something. All right, enough on that. I guess I'm picking on announcers for this episode. Lennox Lewis, he was just really low energy for me. And I think Lennox Lewis likes, you know, it's not like they didn't get a smart guy. Lennox Lewis is smart. I think if he's going to be that kind of low energy, he would function better in like a studio role. Like they go to a desk and they talk to him about something. He makes really intelligent points, but he didn't flow with the emotional intensity of the fight. Some of that is tough. I mean, you're speaking in really short bursts. So if you're making intelligent points, it can be hard to do that in short bursts. Fox, another issue. I hate the running punch count. Please note, this is directed at Fox, not CompuBox. CompuBox usually does a solid job with the punch count. I would say there's probably a disparity here in the real-time count. If they went back and studied the overall tape of this one, maybe I'm wrong. I don't know what the count was. I would have imagined it would have been a lot closer in this fight based on how great this fight was. Overall, though, CompuBox, they do this really well. They do a great job. But my biggest issue of why it's Fox, there's now two fights on this card, and this is a night filled with awesome fights, where the punch stats as a running number didn't really tell the story of the fight. It reduced the drama for me personally. It made you feel like one person was winning when they shouldn't have been in one case. And it made you question why one person won when it looked like they shouldn't have. And I'd compare it to like showing a list instead of showing a score in a football game, just having a running count of total yards or something like that, because that's an important stat, but it doesn't tell the whole story. Fights are not scored by punch counts. The rest of the broadcast went okay. And it was overall, you know, a great night of fights. But the running punch, I think punch counts need to be taken in context and used as an analysis tool in context. All right, enough of all this. Let's go into the preview section, which is going to be short. Two fight cards of note for Saturday, October 12th. Earlier one in the day is ESPN Plus from England. Josh Warrington is defending his IBF featherweight title against Sofiane Takuch. I have no idea. I'm sorry, I'm butchering that name. Nothing else major on the card in terms of a U.S. perspective. Warrington is like a big favorite, 50-1. But more importantly, the only reason why I'm mentioning this, he is one of the key players in a division that may get interesting because there's some guys that are moving up. There's a bunch of younger guys looking to make their mark. He is going to be one of the more established fighters who probably stays down here. Also on Saturday the 12th from DAZN, on DAZN from Chicago, Alexander Usyk is fighting Chaz Witherspoon, who is a late replacement for Tyrone Spong at heavyweight, who failed a drug test. Also on the card, Dimitri Bivol against Lennon Castillo for Bivol's WBA light heavyweight title. A few other interesting names, including Jessica McCaskill, Charles Conwell, who's actually in a really quality fight versus Patrick Day, and then Anthony Sims Jr. Usyk was about a 30-1 favorite against Spong, and And quite frankly, Spong was a former kickboxing champion and a former MMA fighter. He would have brought some of those types of fans who would have viewed him, and I viewed him, you know, as a fan of both sports, I viewed him just still a mismatch, but an interesting opponent. Usyk's now 70-1 or higher against Witherspoon. I mean, you know, there's like the chances of that making it out around like 2 or 3 are just really minimal, in my opinion. Beevil is 35-1. McCaskill's about 12-1. I didn't see odds for Conwell versus Day, but that is probably the best fight on the card, in my opinion. This card reminds me of some of the ones earlier in the year where we saw a bunch of mismatched fights on DAZN. I will cut them some slack because we've seen some great stuff from them recently, and their upcoming stretch is fantastic. But all these are showcase fights. I still would say, at the end of the day, I would have loved to see Carlos Takam, which was originally supposed to be Usyk's opponent. What really matters here, no matter whether it's Takam, who no question would be by far more interesting, or Spong or Chaz Witherspoon, Alexander Usyk just needs to make weight. And I know that sounds weird to say, but it's very different to cut weight and fight as a cruiserweight than it is to put on weight and then successfully do a training camp with the added weight at heavyweight, knowing that you're not going to move back down. Let's just see a camp, let's see a camp where he does that. Let's see this performance. And then we need to see him against, you know, some really top level heavyweights, which I think that's coming. I think that's coming soon. They've not been shy about that. All right. On Friday, October 18th on ESPN from Philadelphia, in one of the best fights of the fall, certainly one of the best fights on terrestrial television this year, Oleksandr Bozdyk is fighting Artur Beterbiev in a light heavyweight unification fight of the WBC and IBF titles. Luis Collazo fighting Kadrutio Abdukakarov at welterweight. I don't think I butchered that. Okay, whatever. Bozdyk is an ever slight favorite. He's like minus 130, but this is about as good as it gets. The odds reflect it. I will be very interested to see what kind of television ratings this card gets. Interesting to see it's on a Friday as well. They're not giving it the Saturday treatment in terms of after a college football game. I will definitely cover that in way more detail on the review and compare what could have happened either way. In the ring, I mean, that is an amazing fight. And we're seeing now, this upcoming weekend is sort of a mini break, and then after that, we're going to see this fight on Friday the 18th. We're going to see on DAZN the Prograis Taylor fight. We're going to see then Canelo versus Kovalev, which will probably, my deep bet will probably be Canelo versus Kovalev next time. There is just so much great stuff coming up. I've already actually kind of talked about the Logan Paul KSI fight. I don't necessarily think that, you know, obviously I don't think that's a great fight. I also don't think it's a disgrace to the sport for reasons I outlined on last episode. And, you know, I think it's an interesting move for DAZN. And then there's fights after that that are good too. Wilder Ortiz is going to be great. All right, I've talked long enough. Good stuff. Best wishes to Errol Spence. I really hope we see him fight. First of all, I really hope he recovers as a human being. And then I really hope we see him fight and continue his career. And I really hope we see him fight at the top level. You know, there are athletes who have come back from this. So best of luck to him. Best wishes.
Did you get what you was looking for?